Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk announced this week she'd been taking an unpaid 4-week leave to recover from a serious illness, an episode of major depression. The story has received a lot of attention, in part because high-profile people admit to struggling with depression, and when they do it, though, they tend to do it after they have recovered. Yet the Anxiety and Depression Association of America estimates nearly 7% of U.S. adults suffer an episode of major depression in any given year, meaning a lot of people are somehow just powering through at work. We wanted to know how they're making it, how depression affects work performance, and if, in fact, people with major depression are better off staying home when they're not well. Psychiatrist Dr. Madhukar Trivedi is here to talk about that. He is director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care and Betty Jo Hay Distinguished Chair in Mental Health at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Trivedi, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
How does depression interfere with one's ability to work outside the home?
So first, thank you for shedding light on this issue. I think when it affects somebody, it affects everything they do, which is one of the things that we often forget. When people have clinical depression and they have experiencing these symptoms, it isn't like you can put it in a separate corner and experience those symptoms at some periods and not others. So one of the things is it remains with you 24 hours a day. Majority of these symptoms really are related to people, their thinking and their feelings. So the sad mood, lack of interest in doing things, their inability to concentrate on their tasks, they're not able to sleep well, they're not able to eat well. And then it has an effect on their interactions, both at home with their spouses or their relatives, and also at work, so that it is, a lot of patients describe to me like depression is where they feel like there's a huge cloud hanging over their head 24/7. So this is something that continuously stays with them, and that has an impact on everything they do and feel.
Do most patients that you deal with attempt to keep working while they're undergoing treatment?
So obviously two things to keep in mind. One is clinical depression is on a range. So for some people, the symptoms are mild to moderate, and for others, they are very severe, and it can go back and forth. For those people for whom it is mild to moderate, they are actually very good at masking so that they are able to go to work. They perform probably not as well as they would normally, but they are able to somehow soldier through. They finish their tasks. And a lot of patients describe as soon as they get home, they're done for the day. Mm-hmm. They sit in front of the couch and do nothing and are unable to actually navigate a lot of their other functions. But they recognize that their work is so important for their livelihood, so they are able to soldier on. But if you really are careful and review their function, they are much better at performance, even at work, even in the mild to moderate range, when they are depressed compared to when they are not depressed. For those people for whom these symptoms become very severe, then sometimes it becomes just too hard. Two major symptoms of the disorder that patients worry about are withdrawn behavior, so they are trying to withdraw from everything. So initially it starts off where people don't want to go to that party they had promised to go to or their social event they wanted to do, but gradually it builds and then they may not be able to go to work.
What do workplaces do in trying to handle this? Because some of the real symptoms of serious depression, including lack of motivation and the inability to sort of focus on things or care about things that one used to, looks to some people who don't know that you have depression like laziness or like just not caring about the job. How can employers be sensitive to the possibility that a worker who used to be doing a great job, has had a performance fall off, might in fact be depressed?
So I see that as three-level problem. One is what the employers and people in their work environment should be thinking about and doing. People in their personal environment should be thinking and doing, and society as a whole. And all three levels, one common thread is really lack of understanding, lack of knowledge that this is a chronic medical disease and that people go in and out, have more episodes or have more severe episodes, and other times they don't. At work, I think that employers have to begin to give their employees permission to talk about it, express the fact that they have clinical depression, they are wanting to or seeking treatment, and really make this like any other medical disease. It has its problems. It does lead to a dysfunction at work and other places, but it also is treatable. And we have to allow people to really be able to talk about it. Unlike some illnesses where there are outward signs, like a fracture or other things, or there are lab tests, unfortunately, in depression, we do not have that. So we have obviously a lot more work to be done to understand the causes of the disease and also the manifestations of the illness.
Some people are worried that if they disclose a mental illness at work, that even if they're able to function okay on the job, that everything they do is then seen through the lens of that mental illness. So in other words, if you disagree with a colleague in a meeting, or if you have a project come up that you don't complete on time, people are going to assume that it's linked to your depression.
I think that is one of the major problems with our societal response, is that we have not accepted this is like any other medical disease. And yes, there are times when you don't function well, but the people with depression actually go on to function very well when they're not depressed. And some of the big examples we've had, high-level public officials or or even, for example, news anchors like Michael Wallace, who were able to function very well when they were not depressed. So just because somebody has had an episode of depression one time doesn't mean that they cannot function other times. So we have to recognize that this is not a permanent illness, that once you have it, you're done. And there are very good treatments available. I think the first step is to recognize this is an illness, that this is a condition that requires treatment. And then if you get into treatment, there's many, many ways of getting better.
What kinds of accommodations make sense for workers to ask for if they are dealing with depression? Maybe it's been a chronic problem for them. They know that they'll get better, but right now they're not doing well. What might they ask for at work to help them get through?
So I think on any given day, they should make the decision that they want to go and approach their either supervisor or employer on a given day when they're not able to function well, and recognize that, report that, and then really deal with it depending on the type of employment. So not all jobs will require them to leave their office for that day, but there may be some that they do. And it is very good to recognize on both sides, on the employer side as well as the employee side, so that they are not seen as people who are shirking their responsibility. There are some days when they just cannot function.
Can a stressful job cause depression?
So that is a very interesting question. We don't actually know what causes depression. We do know that stress in life, early life trauma, for example, physical sexual abuse, predisposes people to having depression. Early genetic predisposition, so that depression runs in families. None of these by themselves cause or lead to depression. So similarly, stressful job itself may not or shouldn't, generally doesn't lead to depression. But a combination of many factors can lead to depressive episodes.
How important is the distinction between clinical depression and what may look like clinical depression but be caused by, you know, trauma, recent trauma, or grief from the loss of a loved one or a divorce or something like that?
So that is a very common mistake that a lot of people make. Often when there is grief or loss, generally loss of a loved one, but sometimes even loss of some social or personal stature, it can lead to grief, which is a feeling of loss, and you're ruminating. So patients, people who go through that, ruminate a lot about it. They think about it a lot, talk about it a lot. In fact, often can even get upset or angry about it. But they are also able to find pockets of time and pockets of interaction where they are reasonably back to where they used to be. And that, so therefore, one thing is it is not like all-encompassing and all the time. And the second part is it is most often very short-lived. So within weeks to months, that is all gone, whereas a depressive episode as part of clinical depression doesn't most often resolve on its own.
When your patients come to you and they've really been struggling and they talk to you about what's been going on at work, how often is it easy for someone to pick up the phone and tell their boss, I can't come in for the next couple of days, I'm depressed?
It is very hard. I have counseled a lot of patients about this, and it is not that straightforward for the very reason you mentioned earlier. It is not just that interaction where you're asking for 2 days off because of your depression. But people recognize that 2 months from now and 2 years from now, that same employer or supervisor will continuously write off your behaviors they don't like as part of depression. When all you were doing, for example, 6 months later, when you are back to normal, you're disagreeing with your boss because the boss is wrong, and yet the boss feels empowered to write it off as your depression. So it is very difficult for people to go to their employer and say, I'm going to take 2 days off for my depression. Very often, people are very happy to be able to go to their boss and say, my arthritis is flaring up, or my hypertension, I need to go and see a doctor, I'm not going to come for 2 days. When it comes to depression, there's obviously a lot of misinformation and stigma. It is the societal aspect that I think we have not paid attention to. This is really a big illness with a lot of people affected. Very rarely would you run into a group of people and ask them, do you know anybody who has had depression? Everybody will raise their hands. So it is very common, and yet we actually, because we don't have a lab test, and that is the kind of work that we in the at UT Southwestern with the center are really focusing on, because we don't have long-term follow-up data, we don't have the lab test, we are not really at a point where people accept it as an illness. There is still a lot of people who think of depression as some kind of weakness.
We know that depression sometimes responds really well to exercise, which is maybe counterintuitive for a lot of people, but there is a great deal of research. Is going to work every day for some people a sort of way of ensuring that their depression is held off if they have a pretty active job? Are there benefits to a job that is not sedentary?
So that, I think, absolutely. So there are two ways of thinking about it. One is there are many treatments available, medication, psychotherapy, exercise, and this aspect that you just described, which has actually been well studied, and we use it in our center also called behavioral activation, where you are really actually making concrete plans to really soldier on and say, I'm going to actively do these three things, even though they are hard, and develop milestones to be able to do it. And in those cases, you can actually continue to function despite your depression, and it will get better. I want to caution to say that that is not possible for everybody. Mm-hmm. So that two things. One, that may not be the right treatment for that particular patient. And for people who have very severe depression, often it is very hard and not possible often. So that is another place where we psychiatry community and mental health community have to do much better. We have to figure out what are the best ways we can match patients and their illness with the treatment. If you go to talk to people, there is always this whole debate about should it be medication or psychotherapy, should it be medication or exercise. And the real answer is, it should really be all of these, and depending on the particular patient, you have to match that with the particular treatment. And we have not, as a field, done enough work to really understand how best to do it.
So are there psychiatrists who think they sort of tend toward psychotherapy, or they tend toward drugs, or they tend toward exercise, as opposed to thinking that any one of the three or all of them in combination might work best?
Absolutely. We have simplified it, and especially in the last 25 years when we got a lot of antidepressant medications available. We started simplifying by just giving a medication and thinking it'll cure it, and it is much more difficult to do.
My guest is Dr. Madhukar Trivedi. He is director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care and Betty Jo Hay Distinguished Chair in Mental Health at UT Southwestern Medical Center. We're talking about depression and working life. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour about the issue of depression in the workplace. My guest is director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care and Betty Jo Hay, Distinguished Chair in Mental Health at UT Southwestern Medical Center, psychiatrist Dr. Madhukar Trivedi. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dr. Trivedi, if we still need to find out what works for individual patients, but also for patients across a broad section, where are we in the research? How well do we understand now what works to help people with depression?
So, in some ways, we are actually much better off today than we were 25 years back. We have a lot of treatments available, and we shouldn't automatically get too depressed about it, in the sense that we should try to make sure that the improvement that we have in terms of treatments, people use it. So medication, psychotherapy, exercise, transmagnetic stimulation, ECT, there are several treatments and patients do get better all the time. I think this glass half empty is the following. We are really 50 years behind where cardiovascular medicine or diabetes was, where they have had the chance to study that for 50 years, and now we know much better about how to manage diabetes or how do you understand the risk for heart disease. So give you those two examples. With diabetes, we have a hemoglobin A1C, or with breast cancer, we have mammograms. For depression, we don't have any of those tests, and therefore people still worry about whether this is some kind of thing in your head rather than a real disease. Secondly, it doesn't help us match patients with the right treatments, because what happens is everybody is treated the same, and it's more of a trial and error process until we get there. So we at the center at UT Southwestern were very lucky. We got a very good lead gift from the Hirsch Foundation. We just started the center at UT Southwestern, and we are actually enrolling two large cohorts of patients, those who have depression right now. We are going to follow them for a long period, hopefully 10 years or longer, to then study their blood tests and their behavior and their brain imaging, etc., in order to come up with this kind of lab tests. We are also going to identifying a similar large cohort of young people who are at risk, that is children of these patients, and follow them in order to identify risk of when they are going to develop a depressive episode. Both of these are needed because we don't actually have large groups of patients with depression who've been followed for 20 years. That is the kind of work we know with heart disease. So why do we know that it is combination of cholesterol and abdominal obesity and smoking and exercise and physical activity and sleep-wake cycle in cardiovascular disease? Because Framingham study has been going on for 50 years. So we have the data for other diseases, not so much with depression. Similarly with diabetes, we know that it is not only insulin. It is insulin and how you eat, how much you exercise, what is your weight, how often you really get your lab tests, etc. In depression, we debate whether it should be medication or psychotherapy, and we don't take a holistic, comprehensive approach. So I think we are getting there. And then the final advantage for us, and that is why we at the center are very excited, is that neuroscience advancement has really rapidly progressed in the last 10 years. So we understand much better about how brain circuitry works. We also have much better tools with imaging like MRI scans. We also have a better idea of the genetics with the genome scan, etc. So we are getting to that point where we are at the cusp where if we do the hard work over the next 5-10 years, I'm confident we'll get there.
All that said, people who've had an episode of clinical depression are at elevated risk for having another episode later on in the future, even if they've recovered. Is that correct?
Absolutely. This is people who experience... So two things to think about this. One is the unfortunate reality, and that is for majority of people, the onset of the depression is way early, often in their teens or their early 20s, and that gets ignored because the first or the second episode often happens related to their first break, relationship and mm-hmm. break in relationship or going off to college, and everybody around there just says, just work it out. And fortunately for a lot of people, that episode is generally short, so people write it off. And by the time somebody gets treated first time, they've had these episodes for 5, 10, 15 years. And then really for the majority of patients, this is a lifelong illness. They may get episodes frequently. They may get it infrequently. But very few people actually get one episode and never again. Because this is really, ultimately, think of it as a circuitry in the brain that is affected. Just because you treat it doesn't mean it is going to permanently get back to normal.
Do we know why a therapy that did work successfully for a matter of months or years either stops working or doesn't work in a subsequent episode of depression with the same effectiveness?
So short answer is that is true of all medical illnesses. What worked for hypertension when you were 25 doesn't work when you're 45. It's not the hypertension. It's just that the disease has marched on.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is that the presentation of symptoms at any given time determines what therapy will work. So 10 years back, if being withdrawn and staying at home was your real major focus of your symptoms, then one kind of therapy might work. And 10 years later, you're irritable and you're not really sleeping well, then a different kind of treatment may be necessary. And so that is, I think, just the nature of the disorder.
How often would you prescribe rest, time off work for a patient dealing with depression if they are not in, in an inpatient care situation?
So my personal, and this is, there is obviously variety of disorder, sort of severity of the illness and a variety of employment status, so it is, doesn't apply to everybody. But my personal bias is to suggest to the person that if you are working in a in an environment where you can be honest with your employer or your supervisor is supportive, then you want to avoid taking time off as much as you can. Because to the extent you can perform at work, it is actually replenishing and is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in an environment where it is so stressful that it is not only going to, your job is at risk, but that they are going to add to your stress, then you take some time off. And it varies with different people. So there's not a standard with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Lauren in Dallas. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I was just calling because I wanted to comment on the working with your employer versus taking time off and kind of just the different provisions that, you know, are occurring nowadays versus, you know, 10, 20 years ago. I was employed with a major Dallas hospital as a floor nurse and had a major depressive episode. My employer was great in working with me. They were very patient. I tried to be very open with them about where I was in my recovery process. And ultimately, I was able to take some time off on short-term disability. I did, I was able to, start to recover. But at a certain point, my employer no longer, I guess they expected me to be better. And instead of working with me to try to provide a job or find a job that was on a lower stress unit, when I realized that I wasn't going to continue to improve without that move, I had to end up leaving the hospital because of their inability to work with me on that. I feel like the mental illness covered under the ADA has really come a long way, but there's still a lot lacking in the ability of employers to provide for those with mental illness.
So one immediate thing is it is unfortunate that it ended the way it did, but I want to commend you for at least being very straightforward and bringing it up with your employer, and they helped you at least initially. It is unfortunate that it ended the way it did, and And there isn't an easy answer, because at some point employers are obviously looking out for their bottom line, and you may have to think about getting a different kind of employment when that happens.
We have an email here from Julie who says, I've heard you speak about biomarkers as a way to identify people who might be able to identify, who have depression, and also connect them to the right medication. Can you explain to people who aren't familiar with biomarkers what a biomarker is and how you would get that information?
So thank you, Julie, for the question. Obviously, the question that I was mentioning about lab tests, so when there is, ultimately, stepping back, this is very clearly a brain disorder that not only affects the brain but also other body functions in the body. And any biological marker that you do, like a lab test, like a protein marker or a metabolic marker or EEG waves or neuroimaging like fMRI marker, that can help us actually A, diagnose, and B, help us match that patient with the right treatment is basically a biomarker. And we are in the pursuit at the center to try to identify a series of biomarkers. Think of cardiovascular disease, low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, triglycerides, all the others in cardiovascular disease are like biomarkers of heart disease. Or rheumatoid arthritis has a number of inflammatory markers you identify, and that is a biomarker for rheumatoid arthritis. For depression, we have not had a good enough database to be able to tell what are the identified biomarkers. We have just recently actually published a study looking at inflammatory biomarkers. So it seems that a small proportion of patients with depression, like about 10%, may have inflammation as one of their triggering factors in depression. And we found different inflammatory biomarkers like TNF-alpha, IL-1-beta, they are inflammatory biomarkers. When we matched those patients with treatment, we found something very exciting. And you mentioned exercise. So if you look at patients with depression who have elevated TNF-alpha, that is one marker of inflammation, they don't do well with standard antidepressant medications like SSRIs, like Prozac. We looked at patients who had not done well on an SSRI and gave them exercise. And what we found is that very group of patients who have inflammation, they did better on exercise than those who did not have inflammation, suggesting that that subgroup of patients with the biomarker in the inflammation range are more likely to do well with exercise and less likely to do well with an SSRI like Prozac. So that is what Julie is asking about, is a biomarker is a test that can help us subgroup a patient either to identify risk before they develop the disorder or once they have the disorder to match them with the right treatment.
So depression can do really disturbing things to one's perception of the world. Certainly people have a more negative self-perception when they are depressed. Are there particular kinds of judgments that people might have to make related to work that they ought to hold off on when they are in the throes of a serious episode of depression?
So it brings up two points. One is I generally tell patients that when they are in the middle of a severe depressive episode, they should hold off on making life-changing decisions of various things, including their employment. But the self-esteem and part that you described actually is a very good trigger to also think about certain kinds of psychotherapy. So not every patient with depression actually has that low self-esteem and questioning their self-worth as the primary focus. But some do. And for those patients, therapy that focuses on that aspect may be most ideal.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Christina in Dallas. Hi, Christina.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Oh, my gosh. I just want to tell you guys that this is a fantastic conversation, and I've been listening so intently. As someone who has suffered from depression and mainly anxiety, I totally agree with the doctor that you need all three. It has to be food and exercise and medication and psychotherapy, and that's been the only thing that's ever helped me. I've suffered from depression and anxiety probably since I was about 13 years old, and now I'm in my 30s, and it wasn't probably until the last year of finally finding a combination of all of those things that I feel like a normal person again. So I'm just so glad that he's shedding light on that this is a true disease. This is something that's going to last you for the rest of your life. And people look down upon it like, well, why don't you just feel better? I'm like, well, that's not really how it works. So thank you so much for opening up this whole new world for people to understand that this is something we're going to suffer from for the rest of our lives.
Thanks so much for your call, Christina. I'm glad you're doing better.
I think absolutely. And Christina highlights one important thing that I think I'm glad you raised the issues you did. We have to get to a point where we educate people to such an extent that patients who have depression become their most ardent advocates and they are best educated about their illness and measurement of what is going on and really expect and demand the whole range of treatments and not just one thing that is thrown at them. This is something that you want to be well educated for yourself. Measure your symptoms and your dysfunction on an ongoing basis with some kind of tool, and people can find those online or they can call, send us an email or call us. And you should be ongoing measurement of these things so that you're keeping almost like a journal or a diary, and you're asking for all kinds of questions of the treaters, whether they're your physicians or your therapists, so that you're combining all possible treatments that you need. Not everybody needs 10 different treatments, but you shouldn't be satisfied with just getting one treatment, making 40% improvement in your symptoms, and say this is good enough. You should be aiming to get to where you are, back to where you were before you had a depressive episode.
Can people who recognize the maybe early warning symptoms that a major episode is oncoming, are there things they can do proactively to make it less severe than it might otherwise be?
Absolutely. I think there are some easy-to-do things, obviously. If you are finding that your sleep pattern is changing so that you're having difficulty with sleep for several days in a row, or if you feel you're getting very much more anxious than you normally are, or if you feel that your appetite is changing significantly over a few days, you should see that as early signs that the depressive episode may be coming and really get again back to your provider, mental health provider or psychiatrist, primary care physician, and talk about it so that they will then review all the symptoms and make sure that this is not the beginning of another episode.
We're speaking this hour with psychiatrist Dr. Madhukar Trivedi, who is director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care, and Betty Jo Hay, Distinguished Chair in Mental Health at UT Southwestern Medical Center. We're talking about depression in the workplace. If you want to join us, you can find me on Twitter at ChrisBoydThink, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour about depression in the workplace with psychiatrist Dr. Madhukar Trivedi of UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Meg in Fort Worth, who says, "My husband functions at a high level at work, but he takes the smallest thing there, a likely meaningless comment or critique or not having lunch with a colleague or something else that is minor, as an absolute catastrophe, career-ending and tragic, and then ruminates over it for days or weeks. How possible is it to find a way forward without clinical treatment if the person with depression is against the idea of treatment?"
So that is the hardest challenge, obviously. If the person is not willing to seek treatment, then there is no immediate easy way to force it. I think that a dialogue is very easy. You can point out these issues, give some reading materials. There are a lot of people who have written books about their personal experience with depression, and also talk about the fact that there are treatments available that will help them reduce this agony and the angst that they experience. And over time, obviously, that is possible to change the person's mind. I think that this suffering that this illustrates you should use all resources in your life as possible, so you can talk to your pastor, you talk to your neighbor, talk to whoever this person, your husband, respects or trusts. Bring them into the picture, because this is something that obviously is leading to significant problems for him, and it is worthwhile helping him.
How often do you find patients who have clinical levels of depression have drunk more alcohol, smoked more marijuana than their neighbors doing that just socially?
So that is a very common difficulty that patients with depression, especially the kind that we just heard the earlier caller talk about, where they don't want to seek treatment, and but the pain is there and the suffering is there. And so they, in a way to numb that pain or suffering, they drink, and often people with depression end up drinking more than they want to, or they end up abusing alcohol. And then the problem obviously escalates and it becomes two problems that one has to deal with.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Puneet on the line in Dallas. Hi, Puneet.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is for Dr. Trivedi. Dr. Trivedi, you just mentioned that the first instance of depression shows up at teenage. I just wanted to ask you, how can we, you know, provide some tools or techniques to our teenagers so that they are better prepared to handle such issues?
So that is a fantastic question, and I think that I'm glad actually you asked it, because I hadn't talked as much about it. I think we have to, as a society, focus on this early presentation in the young age, teenagers, young adults, because the earlier we identify, the better it is. In terms of immediate answer to your question, tools-wise, I think educating and talking about it, giving them permission to come and tell you that I'm having difficulty with the kinds of things that we've already heard today from callers, that I feel question my self-esteem, self-worth, or I'm not sleeping or eating well, or they have suicidal ideation, etc. So giving them, educating them, giving them permission to come and talk to you, their teachers or somebody they respect, are the first two things to do. We as a mental health community and a society have to do better. We should screen people for depression and anxiety much more commonly. I remember when I took my 10-year-old to his pediatrician, they measured his blood pressure first thing. And if you really think about it, the rate of hypertension in 10-year-olds is much lower than the rate of depression in 16 and 18-year-olds. And yet depression is not routinely screened for in young adults, young teenagers. So we also, as a mental health field, have to start doing more of that.
What do you suggest to managers, to employers who have one or more workers who has dealt with depression? You want people to be understanding. You want jobs to make room for hanging on to good employees if they can recover. I also understand the challenges that particularly smaller businesses feel when an employee is not able to sort of do the full workload. Are there ways to educate employers to allow them to get by with less of an employee while that employee is getting back to full health?
So I think that remains a big challenge, and that is not so. One way to think about it is not only an issue with people with depression, but imagine it is also the same issue for somebody who has a fracture and they cannot come back to work for 3 months, or somebody who has diabetes and having diabetic coma or has to go to the hospital repeatedly. That small business is going to have similar difficulties, and I can't imagine to give a total solution to that. On the other hand, I think that educating employees about it, providing them with material, and at least in larger employers, one of the things that I've been remiss in talking about is that larger employers often have EAPs, or employee assistance programs.
Like the 1-800 number that you call up and ask for resources?
And they have in-house employee assistance programs where they have counselors online available in person that you can go to for at least initial evaluation to find out what is wrong. So the first thing we should do is make sure that those resources are A, available, and B, employees are aware of them.
Do those programs tend to be confidential?
They are designed to be confidential, and they are generally designed in most cases to be brief so that they get the initial evaluation and some brief counseling. And at that point, generally triage is made to decide if that is enough or they need to then go to see a psychiatrist or a primary care provider.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Debbie in Flower Mound. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the doctor about how you go about enrolling in the study or this program. I'm calling for my daughter, who is going to turn 30, and she doesn't have insurance. She's got all the ensuing issues that you guys were talking about that go with this, and I would love to be able to try to help her, and it seems like a study like this would at least help her to understand what's going on, and it's very hard to get that kind of care here in Texas for mental health. So
they can call our office at 214-648-HELP. And we'll at least go ahead and talk to them, evaluate, and give recommendations either to be in a study or whether they need any treatment directly.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have, we have J.D. on the line in Irving. Hi, J.D.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask the doctor a question. Having a polio child and then suffering some injuries through life, I have a great deal of pain. However, I have depression secondary to that, it wants to linger. How do you go about treating that?
So pain and depression, similar to other conditions, can coexist, and then you have to evaluate if the pain itself is really exacerbating the depression or depression is independent of that. And so you should get a thorough evaluation and decide. Obviously, people who have chronic pain also have high rates of depression, so it may be that they are both present or that your chronic pain is not under control, and that is now leading to continuing depression.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with John in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hi, Chris and Dr. Trivedi.
Hello.
I have an unusual situation. I'm a senior, 65-plus. I'm the oldest of seven siblings, and two of them committed suicide. Mm. I think we have genetics in the family, and my mother, I was caregiver to my mother and father, and in conversations with my mother, she told me that she had an aunt that looked like an identical twin to my sister who had hung herself in the closet, too. Now, I've been through every kind of SSRI, tricyclics, and everything else over the years. The only thing I found that works for me is cognitive behavioral therapy, where I was introduced to UT Southwestern. I've been in some of your trials over there through the psychiatric department, psychology department, and changing the way I viewed my thoughts changed the way I felt. It's the only thing I found that helps me. It's not always easy to do. And Dr. David Burns is a friend of mine. I lived in California for a while. He's written books on it. And I'll stop here in just a second. He's never treated me, but he's answered questions for me and stuff like that. It's the only thing I found that helps me. I was wondering if you have any ideas about this. I'd love to find a pill like a pop that makes me feel good, gets rid of all my anxiety and depression, but just hasn't happened. And I'll tell you, I'm 71 years old.
Thanks for your call, John.
So so sorry about all the losses in your life. I think that remains the big tragedy of depression. 41,000 people commit suicide every year. And in your case, it is very, very tragic to hear all that. I think the silver lining is what you just described. I think that the treatment that works best for you, and you as anybody, is the one that works for you. And so no point, and I don't argue with success in that. We don't have tools right now to see that one biomarker or one lab test or one mammogram or one hemoglobin A1C matches you with treatment A. Until we get there, I think if cognitive behavior therapy has helped you refocus and rethink the way you interact with the world, and that has led to improvement, I think persist with it. Yes, you may want to think about popping a pill, but I think that until you know exactly which pill is going to do the same, I would stick with cognitive behavior therapy. If it works, then do not give it up.
You said a minute ago that 41,000 people a year die of suicide. How does that compare to the rate of other diseases that we worry a lot about in this country in terms of their mortality?
A number of other chronic medical diseases, including the ones that we feel equally tragedy about, like breast cancer, have deaths that are similar in rates, 45,000 deaths from breast cancer. And so this is just from suicide. With depression, as we've been talking all hour, there are three other significant effects of the disease. One is work environment, so people are not working. Their social environment, their families, their personal relationships are quite affected. And thirdly, overall, not only with the sort of acuteness of suicide, but even overall longevity. On an average, people with depression live 10 to 12 years less than people without depression, so it has a big effect overall, in addition to the deaths from suicide.
How do you convince a brand new patient who doesn't believe anything will make them feel better that, in fact, there is hope?
So that is to some extent where you have to play the surrogate to the patient, where you really are conveying all the information you have. You also are conveying that very fact that you're not going to give up. You will continue to work with the patient until something works. And finally, at least in my clinical practice, what I tend to do is also bring in the support of whoever in their life, so their family, their friends, etc., who will continue to support them in making sure that they at least stay in treatment. And sometimes I even have conversations with the patient where I tell them, if you are willing to suspend judgment until you, at least for the time being, where you start treatment, and then we'll make a decision if nothing is going to work. Because in most cases, doing nothing is not a good alternative.
Many people's well-meaning instinct when they have a loved one or a colleague who is depressed is to point out all the great things in their lives, right? You have a beautiful family, you just made partner, you're physically healthy. The reason that doesn't work is because that has nothing to do with why they're depressed.
Absolutely. The circuits in the brain, for example, are affected, and therefore just telling them that your life is wonderful or you have all this money or all these kids doesn't change it. In fact, it makes them sometimes feel even worse. And what helps them is to recognize their symptoms and remember, if somebody is really walking across the street and is not paying attention and they break their leg, nobody says, well, that's okay. Everybody then attends to the broken leg. Similarly with depression, when somebody has depression that is affecting them, we need to focus on that rather than tell them that you have a wonderful family, so why are you depressed? And that is often the tendency, I think, that we have to be cognizant of. We have to recognize that this is really a brain disease. And if the brain is not functioning well, no amount of money or family in your life will therefore automatically mean you shouldn't worry about it.
Dr. Madhukar Trivedi is director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care, and Betty Jo Hay, Distinguished Chair in Mental Health at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Trivedi, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so very much. Thank you again for shedding light on this.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.